So, hello everybody, at least at my Swiss watch, it's time to start. You are at session 21, which is International Forum on Infection Prevention and Control. And as you can see, there will be major speakers from the different regions of the world. Let me also remind you that the session will be broadcast by the Weber teleclass, so they will be recorded and used at a very international audience. The rule for this afternoon is actually for the speakers for a 7-minute presentation, and I will go on with the 7-minute presentation. So I'm stressing the speakers right now, and I will have a timer, and then we'll keep much time for discussion. The idea would be that they would be presenting the sort of the major challenges and major successes. In 7 minutes, that's quite tough. So we'll start, and I will not present the speakers. They are all famous, so we'll save time for the science and the content. So the first speaker will be Dale. I guess Dale Fisher, you are first. So Dale, come on and get your first speak in 7 minutes. Thank you very much. Dale from Singapore.
Thanks, Didier. How much time did you say I had?
Seven.
Oh, okay, right. I missed that point.
Don't lose this time.
I've got the privilege of talking about the successes and challenges in Asia in 7 minutes. So you'll excuse me if I don't go into too much detail. So that's me. Just briefly, I think. Asia is obviously a very diverse place. There's some fairly unsophisticated infection control standards in some areas. Others, where I work in Singapore, others in Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, there's obviously some quite sophisticated settings as well. There's publications on bundles, whether it's prevention of ventilator-associated pneumonia, MRSA, VRE, hand hygiene. There's many success stories in the region. I would argue that we're probably a bit slow off the mark with the carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, and I don't think the cat's out of the bag yet, but it's half out. My major concern that I'm going to focus on in the next 6 minutes is the concern to the health infrastructure in managing a pandemic, because I think this is where Asia has a major role to play. And as we saw from the SARS outbreak, actually infection control standards or lack of them in hospitals, you can actually see a pandemic accelerated with the sort of incubation that's a hospital. So by way of background, you can see that most human infections, certainly the new ones, start with animals, and there's this concept of viral chatter going on between animals, a little bit of spillage over into humans where there might be some weak adaptation. Some of those, again, will become, such as we saw with H1N1, can become purely human-adapted and freely transmissible human-to-human. So we see that spilling in all the time. About 60% of infections in Asia or infectious deaths are undiagnosed. So there's certainly a lot happening. Perhaps brush fires trying to start, but they don't get off the ground and they're probably not even identified. But the world is certainly getting better at that with communication and attempts at diagnosis of new infections. So just... probably need a pointer here. So just moving around, from the top left, Asia is becoming increasingly urbanised, huge populations. That circle, the world's got a population of about 7 billion, 4 billion live within that circle, and so do three-quarters of the world's chickens. You can see that air travel has just gone crazy over the last couple of decades. There's a close interaction between pigs, cows, chickens, and humans. And especially when you get this urbanisation and effectively rural zones in overcrowded cities now with live meat markets. So it's a natural melting pot for these sort of problems to start. H5N1 is now well established. It's endemic in 15 countries. Fortunately, it doesn't seem to be crossing over to that easily transmissible human to human path. But since we're now up to until recently 637 infections and 378 deaths, we're on top of that. But there's been there's been plenty of warning. SARS in 2003, the outbreak that lasted about 3 months probably, 8,400 cases, 916 deaths, huge costs, probably $30 billion in costs. And for those, just to remind you, this was, I think you could regard it as the most famous infection control problem, which was ultimately controlled by infection control, by isolation, PPE use, and using infrastructure. So in some ways we were kind of lucky that the countries that affected were the more developed ones. You can see from this... I really like a pointer. Oh, I can use this. So... Yes. So you can see the Metropole Hotel in Hong Kong and how there was transmission within one floor there and how those patients got disseminated to different hospitals in Hong Kong, a private hospital in Vietnam which didn't have too much secondary spread, Singapore which obviously had a lot, and Toronto which we heard about yesterday a little bit. And this concept of the super spreader, where someone in hospital could become infected and then transmit to so many others. And once you've got one patient that's capable of spreading to 20 or 30 other people, presumably because of the inoculum, you can see how hospitals that aren't really completely on the mark can be responsible for that development. It's not all about new organisms. This is cases of polio, which is still endemic in at least four countries in Asia. Plague, cholera, they still fester away as potential problems. Dengue, just obviously not. It's not supposed to be a community, a hospital-acquired infection, but a lot of cases annually, and you can see over the last 30 years how that has spread with travel, and just with that travel, we're aware that MRSA is also starting with humble beginnings in the UK. It's now obviously become a pandemically endemic. And this is a graph showing how CRE has really spread from its first identification around 2009, quickly become a world problem. Influenza affected about I think 100 million people, and these wards, you can see how it was really affected about 5% of the world's population, and spread so easily with poor infection control practices. So we argue with the knowledge of how influenza affected and how SARS affected. We have MERS knocking on our door, the Middle Eastern coronavirus. A recent publication in the New England Journal identified clearly reliable human-to-human spread. It's still fairly contained. There's been obviously some small outbreaks in Europe, but it's fair to say it's maintained. I ask, what if MERS reached an Asian hospital and there was a super spreader, as we saw in SARS? It wouldn't be hard to see that and then incubate and spread throughout the world. Here's some photos from Vietnam, just showing the sort of we talk about hand hygiene and environmental cleaning, and I would argue that a lot of Asia is a long way from that when you've got sort of three people in a bed and a bed sort of 50 or 60 centimetres apart. This is a high dependency unit here. So very difficult circumstances with large populations, just ripe for the picking, if you like, for the right transmissible disease. That's, of course, our cleaning tools. So this was a famous quote Or a misquote. I think it's debated whether he actually said this, but this was back in the 60s. It's time to close the book on infectious disease and declare the war against pestilence won. And these lessons are often hard learnt when people celebrate that we have the situation under control. So I think the submarine is going down. And that works because I've finished. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Very, very much. So our next speaker is looking at his watch.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is from the U.S. and actually will summarize the challenge. Don't worry, the time is not ongoing while I'm presenting you. Robert Garcia is from the U.S., from New York, and actually will come with the success and challenges on the side of the United States. Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.
I was just worried that my American watch is not as good as the Swiss, and that's my problem here right now. Okay. I'm going to limit my my lecture down to some of the prevention of the HAIs. We know that there were four majors, but unfortunately, not, you know, with the time constraint, I'll only be able to really cover, I think, two of the issues, and that is VAP and prevention of CLABSIs. Some of the information that you'll see here is contained in an article that we hope to publish very soon. And here you see some of the international authors of a variety of different subjects on the progression over the last decade of prevention in a variety of different issues that affected HAIs as well. So let's start with VAPs. The NHSN is a national healthcare safety network, which is part of the CDC in the United States, and which hospitals report and uplink their data to. It is a voluntary system right now for VAP in the hospitals, but they have quite a number of hospitals reporting their VAP rates. And as you can see here, between the 2 years of reporting from 2006 to 2011, we can clearly see for some of the major ICUs in the United States that we're reporting here are the number of ICUs, the number of VAPs reported, and the vent days. You can see here, for example, cardiac centers, 12.3 rates, medical 3.1, fibrotune, et cetera, et cetera. And you'll see in 2011 now how the means have been reduced. This is in part to do with the implementation of IHI bundles, which were accepted by more than 3,000 hospitals in the United States and appear to be very effective, although we still have quite a ways to go. Here is where I think is one of the greatest challenges, is not only in the United States, but certainly I think that hopefully the idea may spread, and I apologize for using the word spread, which is not very very good to use in this conference. But the point of the matter is that in the U.S. now, the Centers for Disease Control has now proposed a new definition to include VAPs, which is what they call VAEs, ventilator-associated events in adults. This new surveillance definition is to start to be used officially in January of this coming year. And right now, this swing year of 2013 was voluntary for hospitals that wanted to start to use this. Now, why is this a better definition? And here is where I think a lot of the controversy lay, is that the CDC definition prior used definitions which were in some ways not very objective, using chest X-ray interpretations and many findings of the patient that were subjective. That is, that the person who was doing either the care can say that the sputum that was produced, for example, by the patient looked this way, and somebody else would come along and say, well, not really, it's actually, we could interpret it to be this way. So the definition in many studies that were done prior to this may not have been very uniform. So the outcomes then that were to be used may not have been as accurate as we all thought. This is really the new VAE algorithm to be used starting in 2014. And this has been put together by a host of experts in the U.S., which put in their thoughts about what you should eliminate as part of the definition. And they came up with this algorithm. That is that the first tier is what they call ventilator-associated conditions. And the elements that were to be measured is the FiO2 and PEEP levels as associated with a patient on mechanical ventilation. Now, when the criteria is met for this level here, then the next level would be what they call an IVAC, infection-related ventilator-associated complication. And this is the first level in which infection started to be considered. And here were some of the elements that were to be looked at, including fever or WBCs, changes, and a new antimicrobial added to the spectrum of this patient's care. And then third, last but not least, is the possible and probable VAP. And here are the elements of the definition. So they're going to be much more comparable. And I think that this is going to be a great change, and I'd love to see some of the new outcomes from these hospitals that are going to be reporting, because this is going to be actually mandatory for all hospitals. So the VAP challenges are as follows. To set international standards for VAP definition, use of subglottic secretion suction devices, which is something that has been fairly controversial in the literature. Also, another issue is the use of silver-coated tracheostomy tubes. Again, some of the studies, we need to do some expansion there. The possible use of tapered or cylindrical endotracheal tubes, which is only starting to be used in some areas in the United States and would show great benefit. The implementation of what we call comprehensive oral care rather than standard care, which is based tremendously now on our knowledge of pathogenesis and the development of upper respiratory infection, and the extension of the intervention efforts to HAP, which is those patients that develop respiratory infection in the hospital that are not on mechanical ventilation. So let's take a look at CLABSIs. Here is a publication published by the CDC, the last one in 2011, which was national reporting from all 50 U.S. states using the NHSN system, and they're going to be moving to what they call a standardized infection ratio, which is the ratio of observed to expected outcomes. And using this kind of data from all the hospitals that reported, they showed a 41% reduction in the United States in ICU since 2008. The CLABSI challenges are going to really be as follows. Is increasing compliance with the maintenance bundle, and I underline the word compliance. Compliance is going to be really the key for making significant change in any facility throughout the world, because it's wonderful to have things in writing, it's wonderful to talk about new protocols, but if the frontline worker doesn't implement this and you have very high compliance levels, your outcomes are not going to be maximized. The appropriate use of skin antiseptics, this is going to be really critical. In my work, I find that we need to spread the knowledge of how to use antiseptics that are approved to be for the skin. And that is that manufacturers have to work very closely to spell out specifically what is the area size for the antiseptic, for how do you apply it, for how long, and for the drying time, which is not always stated. The type disinfection and replacement of needleless connectors. These are now devices widely used throughout the world, and there have been reports of contamination in their use. So we need to begin to look at second and third generation devices and which ones have better outcomes, how the staff cleans those, disinfects those in use, and when do we replace those. That is still in the literature. We need to do some more studies. CLABSI prevention among neonates. Most studies have been done and published have now been in adults, not have been in the pediatric or neonatal, particularly neonatal populations, and we need to get a better handle on prevention there. CLABSI prevention among the immunocompromised patients is still a very, very big area. We've eliminated, in a large part, gram-negative infection, but we still have ways to go with the gram-positives, and how do we do that best? Oh, my watch is going off. And decolonization of patients with central lines with chlorhexidine is another area that we need to examine very carefully, and particularly not only in patients in the ICUs, but patients who have central lines outside of those ICUs. So I'm going to leave you at that. Here's a bathing study, et cetera, and I won't take up too much more of the time, but thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Robert. Sorry for the time. It's the Swiss watch. So next speaker is Hugo Sachs from Switzerland, but he's going to present for Europe, right? So Hugo Sachs
for Europe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a bit of a stretch for a Swiss guy to talk about Europe, but that's the challenge for me. And, you know, there is always this white spot in the middle of these colorful maps on epidemiological data because we are not allowed to feed in our data into the European network. So I'm starting with the colorful map here, but this is showing per capita income in over the world, and it's well known that this is not equally distributed, and you see more money being earned in the north, Australia, and not so much in the south part of the world. When you zoom in into Europe, there is also not equal distribution here, with the darker colors being the poorer regions in Europe in the east and more money towards the north and the west. So we keep this in mind, and I would like now to come to the success. And the success that I identified to present to you today is based on this European Union Council recommendation 151/01 on patient safety, including the prevention and control of healthcare associated infections, and more specifically the paragraph 8CE. And it's on performing surveillance of healthcare associated infections, because we know they are mostly endemic, and they don't show up if you don't going to look and see what they are. More specifically, it actually is, I think, a real success to have a prevalence study survey on healthcare-associated infections and antimicrobial use in Europe in 2011 and 12. And there were more than 1,000 hospitals included in 30 countries, and 230,000 patients included. And the objectives were to have more knowledge on the burden of disease of healthcare-associated infections in Europe, but not only on infections, but also on some other parameters like antibiotic use. And the healthcare-associated infections were stratified according to hospital type and type of infection. And the other objective was also to disseminate this knowledge and to raise awareness of this whole problem of healthcare-associated infections and issues and priorities, and deliver a standardized tool for the quality improvement. So this brings me to the results. And I would include in the results, in parentheses, the failure that I'm going to present to you. And the first failure, I would say, is that there is still shown by this survey a lot of room for improvement on every level, on procedure level, on structure level, but also there are still infections probably that could be prevented if infection control would be better and hospitals would do a better job. Another failure that also is to be understood in parentheses is the fact that this study is not perfect. And there has been a validation if the study was representative for countries in Europe, because they were meant to do a sampling strategy to include a representative sample of hospitals in every country, and some countries failed to do that. We will see it. Here is the main result, healthcare-associated infections. At that point prevalence, 15,000 patients were found to be infected in the hospital, 6%, 2 to 10% in the variation between countries. And you see in light green the predicted infection rate based on case mix and hospital characteristics, and that the lower the countries reporting lower rates were more exposed to underreporting, with around 72% of sensitivity to find healthcare-associated infections according to validation in these hospitals. Here you see the country representativeness of these data in 8 countries that was not achieved. The staffing, they also got figures on staffing, and you see that in median one nurse per 250 hospital beds, which is now probably half what would be today the standard. And you see now, thinking back on the map of the distribution of money in Europe, that staffing is less good in the eastern part and southern part of Europe. Then the use of antibiotics, one of the procedure values. You see that there is a variety that is probably not justified by the type of patients or care that you give. More antibiotics used in the south. And this correlates with the fact that it was not documented why these antibiotics were given, so that was also not equally distributed. Antibiotics were used half of the time for healthcare, for community-associated infections. And you see a big part of these antibiotics were given for surgical prophylaxis, which is good, but half of this in light green on the graph on the right were given more than one day, which is not recommended. Then the impact on antibiotic resistance here, MRSA, not equally distributed. Again, there where more antibiotics are used, you get more resistance, which is well known. And the problem of carbapenem resistance in Europe, you see that there are, that was reported in this meeting before, that there are some regions where this is really a problem with 10 to 25 or over 25% of resistance. In Switzerland, you see on the left, it's not yet a problem. And last but not least, a procedure indicator for the standard of care, the consumption of alcohol-based hand rub per 1,000 patient days, and the median was 18 liters per 1,000 patient days, and that would mean that more or less patients are touched between 5 and 10 times a day, and probably this is not the case, because otherwise it wouldn't be really an acute care hospital. Patients would more or less remain on their own. Thank you.
Thank you for being perfectly on time. Swiss watch. Next speaker is Carol Fry. Don't worry, I don't start the watch now. And she will be speaking about UK, right? Which is part of Europe.
I'll explain.
You will explain. Okay, welcome. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you very much. And thank you for asking me to contribute to this session this afternoon. I have set myself the mission not to set dead ears alarm off. This is a view from England. Health in the UK is devolved to the four countries of the UK, so I need to say that up front. And I'm sure any of my colleagues from Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland will be happy to contribute to the discussion, as indeed my colleague from the Republic of Ireland who's sitting over there. So I've taken a slightly more generic parochial approach into looking at this. And if we were in this room 10 years ago, we were opening the newspapers every single day and seeing headlines about MRSA. It seemed to be the only bacteria or infection that the media understood. It had huge public and political focus, and the general public seemed to be of the opinion that they were going to be admitted to a dirty hospital. They would get MRSA in that dirty hospital, and it would kill them. So we were under the spotlight, and that was a UK phenomenon. But I'm going to report about what happened in England. And this is the success story about the reduction in MRSA. It's quite a busy slide, and that's to demonstrate the huge amount of interventions that were put in place. The first most meaningful intervention was to develop a target to reduce MRSA bacteremias by 50%. And many of us thought that you cannot possibly set a target against a microorganism. And I think most of us have been eating our hats ever since. Now, what we can't tell with the benefit of hindsight is what was it that made the difference. We cannot disaggregate out which were the most effective interventions. And interestingly, I'm writing a paper on this very story with a couple of colleagues, and I have put together all the policy initiatives, announcements, reports, the list goes on, and I've got a 20-page table. So these are just the highlights. So an awful lot of effort went into MRSA. There will be people and have published to say that actually these infections were decreasing anyway, and did this make any difference? And I don't think we will ever know. So that is our success story, and it put infections in the spotlight. It put all of us in the spotlight. We'd been going on for years how important infection control was, and finally we had our moment in the sun. We did get organisational and management awareness, but that was because we had a target and the financial penalties applied. So once you get your financial director involved, it really does change the game. We did have a degree of clinician engagement, much more than we'd had before. Previously, infection control was seen the domain of the infection control team, and it was their problem. They had to get it sorted. So I think we have gone some way in getting other parts of the healthcare system engaged. I think we've got a way to go, and we can't be complacent. I've talked about the change in the nomenclature. And I know it's a matter of semantics, but to actually talk about healthcare-associated infection, not hospital-acquired infection, I think was an important change. And I don't know that's been reflected globally, to say that it's not just a hospital problem. And as the delivery of healthcare changes, I think it's very important that we remember it's not just a hospital problem. And for years we talked about infection control. Well, we didn't set our sights very high, did we? We only wanted to control them. We didn't want to prevent them. And I know infection prevention control is a big mouthful, but I think it's important that we actually do talk about that. So that was our success story. And one interesting thing when the target was devised was the people that did that said we will get a slipstream effect. If we get it right for the MRSA bacteremias, all the other infections will follow suit. That was not the case. So, for example, we know that our sensitive staffs have not decreased in the same way as the resistant staffs. Why is that? With all the efforts we've put into MRSA, why hasn't it been replicated in the sensitive staffs? This is a snapshot from the Chief Medical Officer's Report for England report that she published earlier this year on antimicrobial resistance. She's made it her mission to make this a hot topic. And the reason I put this snapshot up is the small circle represents 1.6% of MRSA, whereas the E. coli for the big circle, that's 36%. So that reminds us that really the gram-negatives are something that we need to be addressing, and that has been a theme at this conference. And it also tells us that the epidemiology of hospital infections, healthcare-associated infections, changes over the years, because back in the 1970s, so I'm told, I was actually at school then, gram-negatives were the big issue, and then it became the gram-positives. So is this just a natural evolution that we're seeing? So what I've described in the future challenges, that we have to recognise this is a global issue, and that was why it was so nice to have the previous speakers, because I think we're all saying the same thing, even though our presentations have been very different. I think the gram negatives are important and are challenging us, and antimicrobial resistance, as we all know, is a big challenge. One thing that I was very pleased to see in the CMO's report, she had said, and I wanted to hug her for this, that she said we must take the policy context beyond MRSA and C. diff. It's almost like this has always been about two organisms. And whilst they're important pathogens, there are lots of other organisms out there. So I think it behoves us, as in specialists in this area, to actually communicate that message to people, that whilst we've done some very good work, we mustn't be complacent. I think complacency is one of our biggest risks going forward. Another theme of this meeting has been about behavioural change. how we do that and how we sustain that behavioural change. And I think that is one of our very biggest challenges to the future. And there I'll finish, and I've beaten the alarm. Thank you, Didier.
Seconds left. Please, stay here. Could all the speakers come on the podium, please?
Thank you very much.
Please, have a seat. Thank you very much for being so on time and really dedicate your time to what seems to be the most important. Time for questions. The good part of having this very stretch is now anybody can ask question to any of the speakers or to all of them. Questions from anybody in the room. If you allow me, I would start and I would ask the question to all four speakers. What actually would be to you the common challenge that would actually cross the entire infection control community through the four of your region? And of course, Dale, you are close to me, so you answer cross. First. Let's go.
What was it again?
The common challenge for all of us.
I'll go back to my slide on the first day with Captain Jack Sparrow, which said, the problem's not the problem, it's your attitude to the problem that's the problem. So if that was one theme, it's that. The we can deal with all the problems if we've got the support, I think.
Okay. Robert?
Essentially, it's implementation. In other words, we have a lot of knowledge in a lot of these areas of how to prevent, generally. But the problem is, how do we implement all of this and making sure that in all our settings, and like you had a very good point, it's not just a matter of hospitals or critical care. You know, step-down units, long-term care, you know, we have patients going back and forth between these facilities, and we need to have some more uniform protocols that are certainly performed by the majority of people.
Yes. Hugo?
For me, it would be the problem, the disconnect between behavior and the perception of what happens when you don't do what you should do during care and the infectious outcome. So I think if this low risk when you do not disinfect your hands before touching a patient, this low risk gives us a hard time and is a challenge. And we perceive this and we skip it. And then, like cigarettes and lung cancer, the next cigarette is not making a difference. But if you keep on smoking, then in the end, the risk becomes very real.
Okay. Carol, I'm conscious that you're the last one, so maybe more difficult. But
and obviously agreeing with all my fellow panel members, I think on top of that, I would like to articulate, certainly I work in a government department, that there is not a magic bullet. People seem to think if we can just find that magic bullet, we will solve this problem. There isn't a magic bullet. If there was, we would have found it by now. And to try and articulate that this is quite complex. And the other thing, I think we need to learn from history. I talked about the gram negatives. Now, colleagues in England, if you go back to the literature of the 70s and 80s, they did a lot of work on the gram negatives. We need to also look at those lessons learned. We're not very good at doing that. And I was talking to somebody earlier that modern infection control arrangements came about in England as a result of a very large outbreak in the mental health trust. But how much we held about mental health and infection? So we need to look back, not sort of in a retrograde way, but to learn from the past.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you very much. You see the idea are really coming together. Very nice. Any question from the room? Yes, please. Go to the microphone or speak very, very loudly. Sure.
How goes
Well, Dale, I'll let you start.
Yeah, and then you'll finish. No, I think this is crazy, me answering this question. There's some excellent WHO initiatives on training, on manufacturing your own alcohol-based hand rub, and there's some excellent success stories, but you should say them, not me.
Well, I think that it is very clear that, and Dale's presentation was also touching on these, that there are specific challenges to the developing countries, hospitals and, you know, institutions. It is also true that they have the same challenge as we do in the so-called developed countries. It is true that the rates of infections are higher in those places, according to many different data. What is true is that by implementing solutions that are simple solutions on those places, you can achieve a lot. And, of course, rate reduction would be higher in those places. And we recently published these results in the Lancet Infectious Disease, speaking of hand hygiene, for example, showing that not only the strategy that is pushed forward by WHO is efficacious worldwide, but it's even more efficacious, of course, in places where there is more to learn about it. But one thing that I would like to say also is that we used to say, you know, the problems are in the South, so-called, quote-unquote, developing countries, and the solutions are coming from the North, so-called developed countries. But it's not only as simple. We are learning a lot also from the so-called the South. They are using very simple techniques that we could certainly apply in our institution. To give you an example, we have a very practical place where we are doing very, very simple post-discharge surgical site infection surveillance at 30 days using a mobile phone that works very, very well, getting a more than 98% of surveillance information at 30 days, which is something I would love to get in our institution. So I think that we are all learning from each other. And yes, WHO, but there are other institutes that could help implementing appropriate infection control in the so-called developing countries. I can tell that things are going very, very fast over there. The good thing is that in our hospitals, you know, we have a lot of guidelines, we have a lot of things to do, and as soon as you go for implementation, as you say, people say, oh yeah, come on, we have so much to do that this one we can do. In the developing countries, the bad luck that they have makes them concentrate on the most essential things that are to be applied, and sometimes it's to the great success of the implementation. That would be what I would have to offer. Any other comment from you? Questions? Yes, please.
Didier, I think they need to go to the mic because this has been telecast, isn't it?
Oh, because of the teleclass. Yes, correct. Thank you, Carol.
So, Didier, my question is that most of the countries in Europe and globally are facing considerable financial challenge. All of the health systems are changing. The European countries that we know, there is restructuring of the healthcare system. In this pressurized healthcare system development and evolution, how do we continue to keep the focus on healthcare infection prevention control and infection reduction? I think this is a huge challenge, and I'd like to hear from all of our speakers of what their solutions may be as we hit the financial wall.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I will start with Carol, and we'll take the opinion of all the leads on the table.
Thanks for letting me go first on this one. I don't know the answer, Barrett. I really don't, and I'd be surprised if any of my speakers know the answer. We are working sort of financial straitened times. You know, people talk about working smarter. What does working smarter mean? I think we've got a very big job ahead of us. To be very parochial again, the English Health Service is going through a lot of changes. So we are struggling a lot at the moment to know how those new systems work. So I'm afraid that's not much of an answer because I don't know the answer.
Hugo?
I think resources are really very central to success in infection prevention. But on the other hand, thinking of our research, qualitative research in Europe in several ICUs where we went and did interviews with people on the introduction or implementation of central venous line prevention, I know that there are also in resource-poor situations sometimes leaders and teams who succeed in doing the right thing. And this is sometimes just talent and dedication and determination that lets them succeed and get the money from somewhere and find the solution somehow.
Robert?
Well, I mean, you know, coming from the United States, it's also a very difficult thing to answer. You know, you have hospitals that can afford the latest and the greatest technologies, and yet what? You can still see them with elevated HAI rates. And what's the answer? Well, the answer isn't necessarily in newer technology. The answer is getting back to basics. And unfortunately, the problem also is, I think, you probably agree with me, is that you don't necessarily have the ability, even in the U.S., to screen patients for things that they may have. And one of the huge issues is gram-negatives. I mean, we have a lot more experience with screening for Staph aureus, MRSA, identifying those patients and isolating and doing those very basic things like hand washing. But now with challenges of organisms which are causing major infections, we don't even have the resources in order to start screening every patient, even who might be at risk. Forget about screening every patient. And I think that that's part of the core of what you would do in any infection prevention program. So the answers are right now elusive. I'm sorry.
Dale?
I'm much more optimistic than that. I think there's a big mindset issue which sometimes stems from us out of our frustrations. And I can't imagine buying a faulty car where the, you know, 5% of the brakes didn't work. And we just have to say that's unacceptable. And I think the language we have to present is data, which is very hard to argue with. And I think the UK with the MRSA bacteremia, that's what people latched onto. And you could use that to say, look how bad it is. We can bring it down with this support. So using data with a little dash of media, is there, and we just need to be banging the drum saying this is unacceptable. Patients shouldn't come in for a gallbladder removal and end up with a bacteremia. You know, it's so I think it's partly in our mindset, and I think we need to speak the language of data that means something to important people.
Thank you. I would agree with what has been said, of course. I mean, it's clear that you can do a lot with basic things. That's one thing, and this is good. And once you succeed, you will see a lot of things happening after that. These are things that we are observing in many different countries where there has been changes into real, bedside infection control in the context where infection control is now placed at a much higher level in the institution and in governments or in different settings. The benchmarking of data, comparison of data, the role of role model like Hugo's pushed, and the role of implementation and success. I mean, getting the success known by others would certainly help. I completely agree that we are always asking our teams to do more with less, but I think that we should continue and go on and go on, and certainly, I mean, celebrate the success. Celebrate the success will actually help supporting a way to get sustained action, and I think that we are in a much better place than we used to be 10 years ago, if you want to summarize it in a very sort of a take-home message sentence. So that would be my vision. Pleasure. I hate to close the session. It was an outstanding session. I would like to thank very much the four speakers for playing the role. I need to remind you that tomorrow morning, if you come at 7:30, you will have rolls and coffee and tea. And then at 8, there will be a special session of Peter Hoffman. And I need to tell you that you need to rush from now to go to the gala dinner tonight. Rush is probably a little bit too much, but please take time to go there. It takes some time to go there. And looking forward to see you tonight at the gala dinner. Thank you very much for your attention. And thanks to the speakers.
Excellent, thank you.
Thanks
very well.